Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, January 24th. As we prepare to mark the Lunar New Year in Chinatown later this month, we explore some of its history. This week marked the 125th anniversary of the Great Fire in Chinatown, an attempt to curb the spread of the bubonic plague. Today we salute our fire department with Hanaho stories about the downtown neighborhood and its history. We acknowledge the stories of bubonic plague and fires in our Honolulu and hear from a poet inspired by that history. His family's store burned in the blaze. And we go along on a walking tour with an architect who points out the features of downtown which survived the conflagration and still exist today. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. It isn't often that we lose a firefighter in the line of duty, and tomorrow the community will give a final salute to a young fallen firefighter. Jeffrey Fiala will be laid to rest, and a pass-in review will take place past his fire station in Kaka'ako. It will start at 10 a.m. from the Nu'uana Mortuary and proceed past the HFD headquarters. Fiala died while fighting a house fire on Yonge Street this month. It's a reminder of the risks our first responders take every day in the job to keep us safe. The museum at the HFD headquarters in Kaka'ako houses a bit of history of the department, which includes the Great Fire in Chinatown. This past Monday marked the 125th anniversary of the blaze, which burned 16 blocks. Miraculously, not a single firefighter was lost. We thought this month we would replay some of the stories about that fire in our Honolulu. It's a nod to the history of the fire department, which includes the Hawaiian monarchy. Take a listen to a recording of a visit last year by HFD new recruits to the Royal Mausoleum at Mauna Ala. Captain Barney Po'okela Hansen explains why four ali'i in particular are so important to the department.
The purpose of us as a fire department visiting Mauna Ala is truly to ground ourselves physically, spiritually, mentally, and to honor and pay respect to our ali'i. Of course, all the ali'i, but in particular, Prince Albert, King Kalakaua, and Kaui Keoli Kamehameha III, they all were a part of our HFD Ohana, meaning Prince Albert, an honorary firefighter with Engine Company 4. Kalakaua was also a member of Engine Company No. 4. And Kaui Keoli founded our department in 1851.
Work on a comprehensive book about the history of the Honolulu Fire Department is currently underway. We talked to one of the driving forces behind the book. Paul Fox's passion is firefighting. He served as a training liaison for the Hickam Federal Fire Department, as well as assistant training chief for the Chiang Mai Fire Department in Thailand. For years, Fox has been poring over boxes of records, and his plan is to publish a book later this year. Fox talks about Kalakaua's role in the Chinatown fires before he ascended to the throne.
At the Great Fire, he led many a campaign to save sections of the city. He was the one that said, okay, we make our stand here. That building we cannot save. We're going to make the stand here, and we're going to save the rest.
If I recall, there's a plaque at a building down there in Chinatown acknowledging that he had helped to fight the fires.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. I haven't gotten down there to find it and get a picture of it. It needs to be in the book.
So what else were you able to find in your research about those fires in Chinatown?
The actual fire started in December of 1889, was the first fire, and these were called sanitation fires. They were designed to kill off the rats. In fact, there was at one point, there was a bounty on rats. that the city was paying, and people were showing up with, here's a bag of 50 rats and here's your money. And they were out with shotguns shooting rats. It was to control the plague. Now, there's a lot of debate, and we get into it a little bit in the book, about it being Chinatown. And there were cases of bubonic plague outside of the quarantine zone. There was a section that was considered the quarantine zone. In fact, the China Engine Company, Chemical Engine Company number 3, was within the quarantine zone. And became a problem. Back in those days, the fire stations didn't have kitchens to feed them. So that the chief had to get special permission to have somebody enter the quarantine zone to feed the firefighters and come back out. In the early portion of the fire, it was the quarantine zone was designed to keep the infected controlled. In fact, armed men with axe handles roamed the streets to beat back any Chinese that were trying to escape the quarantine zone, even during the fire.
And the fire did burn a church, Kamakapili Church, that had to be then rebuilt in another area.
Yeah. The fire actually was started just Makai on the Waikiki side of the church. And it was designed, the wind was right and everything, but as soon as the fire started, the wind shifted and rose. And a flying ember got into the Waikiki spire of the church, and that was out of the reach of the hose streams of today. And there was a very heroic effort done by firefighter Hoseman Mack, used ladders to get up into the top of the church, got as high as he could when axe chopped his way through the ceiling, through the roof, got up onto the roof. Once he popped his head out, the cheers from the crowd below, was enormous. He brought up what was called a Bagcock extinguisher, which is about, you've seen the 2.5-gallon water fire extinguishers around. It's a little bigger than that. And he hauled that all the way up into the roof and attempted to fight the fire. Failing that, he barely got out in the nick of time. Two other firefighters had advanced a hose line within the church. Suddenly, their water was cut off. And they came running out to discover the steps to the church and their hose were in flames. And they barely got out.
And so as you were doing all this research, where did you get all this documentation?
Oh, numerous sources. Digging through dark, dirty crevices of storage areas and whatnot to find countless old documents, going through old handwritten letters. And back then they wrote in a very flowery style.
Cursive,
impossible to read. And we had to read all this.
And these documents, they were all held by the fire department?
Some were held by the fire department, some from private collections, some from what I had. I maintain a very large collection of thousands of photographs of the history of the Honolulu Fire Department. And a lot of that came from that. And that was leads to other things.
So this book then will include a lot of those photos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the other sources was, I think it was 1989, they discovered a safe in the basement of Central Fire Station on Baritania Street, at Ford Street in Baritania. And nobody had this combination of the safe or knew anything about this safe being down there. So the department hired a locksmith to crack the safe. And when they opened it, in it was the original documents ordering the fire department to burn what they burned.
In Chinatown.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we now have copies of all these original documents signed by the Board of Health directing the fire chief that buildings X, Y, and Z will be burned at this time on this date. If I could give one last shout out to one individual that has been, for especially the Chinatown fires, a tremendous help, a tremendous resource. And a lot of this comes from him, is Gary Cover. He has written nearly a dozen books on the history of downtown Honolulu. Probably his most famous one is Honolulu Chinatown, 200 Years of Red Lanterns and Red Lights.
We've been hearing from Paul Fox, who, along with Gary Cover and Sam Danaway, are compiling a book on the first 100-year history of the Honolulu Fire Department. Danaway is a fire protection engineer, and Fox says he is credited with crafting many of the present-day fire safety laws.
Support for HPR comes from Kahilu Theater in Waimea on Hawaii Island, presenting the Germany-based Aoi Trio, performing music of Beethoven, Hosokawa, and Dvorak, February 2nd. Tickets at kahilu.org.
The family of Jose Fajardo, HPR's former president and general manager, invites you to make a donation in his memory to the HPR Jose Fajardo Student Internship Fund. The fund will help introduce local students to career opportunities in public media. To contribute to the fund, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/intern.
Support for HPR comes from Anthology Finn Partners, helping Hawaii businesses with integrated solutions, including research, public relations, advertising, and digital marketing. Anthologygroup.com.
Let's go back in time when the bubonic plague, also known as the Black Death, made its way into our Honolulu. It was likely a rat brought over on a ship that harbored a tick or a flea carrying the disease. Its first victim in the city was believed to be Yu Chong, a Chinese bookkeeper whose office was upstairs in a building on Nu'uanu Avenue, across from what we know now today as Murphy's Bar and Grill. Chong fell ill on December 9th, and 3 days later, he was dead. The Black Plague quickly spread from building to building in Chinatown. A month later, officials decided to burn structures where people died of the disease, starting with one building each day. Karen Motosui is one of the co-founders of the Hawaii Heritage Center in downtown Chinatown. She says when she leads walking tours, she talks about the bubonic plague and the Great Chinatown Fire at the corner of Nu'uanu and Baratania. She picks up the story at the Wing Wo Tai building.
In that same building, a few days later, a second bookkeeper dies. I mean, by that time, the Department of Health is saying, God, we have a big problem here in Hawaii. And about 4 months prior to that, Hawaii will hire the first bacteriologist. Previous to that, everything had to be sent to the mainland for testing. So pretty much they knew that they were dealing with a bubonic plague in Hawaii. So the Department of Health started to quarantine areas where people had died. But eventually, within 10 days of the first bookkeeper's death, there were 10 other deaths. So they felt they had to evacuate, not only quarantine, but the quarantine is over now. All you people in here, get out of Chinatown. You're looking at over 5,000 immigrants living in Chinatown area. And they were told, get out of Chinatown because we're going to start burning. These are wooden buildings where somebody died of the bubonic plague. And that's how that big fire started.
Right. So the whole idea was to systematically clear the area where they knew someone had died of the bubonic plague.
Yeah, they were trying to kill the bacteria and any rats that were carrying the tick on its back. For the people living in Chinatown, it was their day of infamy because they were very poor. One of the pictures just is seared into my mind is at the State Archives, and it shows hundreds of people with their belongings in a sheet and little children, and they're running from the west end of Chinatown to Kawai Hau Church, which was where they were supposed to go to wait out the fires, and then they could go back. And the other sanctuary was Kaumakapili Church, where these people whose buildings and neighboring buildings were being burnt were told to wait out the fire there. But unfortunately, as we all know, Kawai Hau Church caught on fire because the first fire that was set at the corner of King and Uwanu, that this is at the time when, like today, there's high winds from the Pali. And it's those high winds that then just spread the fire and literally wiped out the buildings in Chinatown. You know, I grew up on Kaumakapili Lane. Our address was 1220B Kaumakapili Lane. And so I grew up knowing that at one time, Kaumakapili Church was there. And in the old days, you know, streets and lanes and whatever was named after whoever had the biggest building. So Kaumakapili Church stood between Nu'uanu Avenue and currently Smith Street. Between Nu'uanu and Smith Street was Kaumakapili Lane. So I grew up knowing that there was a Kaumakapili Church and that it burned during the Great Fire because we had that address. And of course, after Kaumakapili Church burned, you know, they rebuilt it in the Palama area. It's now across from Thomas Shiro Market, has been there and is still a historic building.
You know, as we reflect on the 125 years since this first case and then the fire that happened in January, what comes to top of mind as you reflect on this anniversary?
On one hand, when I look back on that big fire, I have a lot of pain in my heart for all those immigrants that were trying to run away from the fire, get out of the fire. The other thing is that if you are in a building where somebody died, the Department of Health put you through some very degrading behavior, like you have to come out of your building, you have to strip naked, they sprayed you with some kind of disinfectant, and then you left, and then they said, okay, now go. So if you were in a building where somebody died, you had to go to this kind of embarrassing, inhumane treatment. So, I mean, really, when I think about those people during the time of the quarantine and the evacuation out of Chinatown, it kind of reminds me of the people in Gaza maybe now. The second thing is that today in Hawaii and in the United States and really in the world, what we're really fortunate about is that we have testing that can be done. You know, the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture is telling people, if you have a dying bird, chicken, duck on your property, call us. We want to pick that dying animal up and test it for avian flu. But back then, in the 1899s, the rats were dying, but everybody was clueless as to why were the rats dying. And the rats were probably dying because they had the bubonic plague. So we're so fortunate today that medical science is at a point where they can keep us healthy, you know, COVID-free, avian flu-free, by doing testing of not only humans, but animals. So the avian flu, you know, like the bubonic plague, the prevention is to try to get it not to hop onto the human. Yeah, the American researchers feel that the COVID went from a animal to a human, and that's how it got spread.
Karen, you know, your passion is to preserve the history of the downtown area. You know, it's not just the Chinese story, but it's really the immigrant story.
It's multicultural, yeah. You know, because at that time of the bubonic plague, when the quarantine and the evacuation of the people to get out of Chinatown, about 50% of the people were Japanese and the other 50% were Chinese. They were also maybe 10% Hawaiians. And we had a mixture of other smaller groups, like the Greeks were in Chinatown at that time. So were the Puerto Ricans. And so were the Spanish people. These are all people who are coming off of the plantation and coming into Chinatown to live. So during the plague, although majority of the people were either Chinese or Japanese, we did have a very multicultural community here in this whole area, which is spans from Fort Street Mall all the way to Palama area was considered Chinatown. And from Nimitz Highway to School Street, which is one block past the H1 freeway, that whole area was considered Chinatown. So this was a pretty massive area of immigrants really moving from the plantation and deciding they're going to stay in Hawaii. Chinatown is the place they come to.
Well, we are glad that the Heritage Center exists downtown there on Smith Street, and you do run those tours. The public needs to know that you're a treasure trove of stories down there.
You know, our archives and our historic library is dedicated only to preserve the immigrant history of Hawaii. So, unfortunately, we have very little Hawaiian material because, you know, Iolani Palace is there, Bishop Museum, mm-hmm. Summer Palace. You have many Hawaiian institutions preserving the Hawaiian history and culture. So our focus has always been on the immigrant history and heritage in not only Chinatown, but, you know, throughout the state.
So if people want to learn more, they can go to your website and book a tour.
Yes. Well, we have been in Chinatown since 1980. This is, to us, the most historic district in all of Hawaii, because remember in the early 70s, when the Chinatown Historic District was created by the federal government, Department of Interior, there were 55 buildings. So there's nowhere else in Hawaii where you have a high concentration of historic sites.
That was Karen Motosui, Vice President of the Hawaii Heritage Center, who we talked to last December. The center continues to offer walking tours of Chinatown on Wednesday and Friday mornings. The Great Fire burned for 17 days and destroyed 38 acres of structures, including a shop owned by the grandfather of local poet Wing Tek Lum. He acknowledges that time in history in his new collection of poems entitled The Old Timers. It's his third collection of poems, and a section is dedicated to life imagined during the Great Fire. He joined us in studio recently to discuss the book and begins by reading us a poem entitled The Fire.
The Fire. The health board condemns the shanties as someone inside has died from the plague. Other inhabitants are summarily evicted, gathering whatever they can, but with nowhere to go. The fire department surrounds the perimeter, poised with their hoses for the start of the burn. A crowd converges, curious, angry, and resigned, and worried that they themselves will be next. The fire is ignited as rehearsed, but unexpected gusts come down from the valley. Firemen vainly try to contain its spread. People are stunned, immobile, uncertain about what to do. Before long, embers billow up, wafted by the wind, and jump from rooftop to rooftop. Residents rush to stamp out spot fires, tearing down even their own houses to form fire breaks. Narrow alleyways turn into gauntlets of flame. A fire scours the street, combusting all in its path. Faces are blistered, hair singed, eyes wide from fear. Everyone is shouting, drowning out the chaos. A store selling fireworks for the new year explodes. A lumberyard blazes. A few run home to retrieve gold or papers. Most, though, just flee with the clothes on their backs. Inexorably, the inferno marches toward the wharves. It melts electric coils and a hastily abandoned fire engine. Volunteers carry on their backs women with bound feet. Opium addicts delirious are rescued from their den. The refugees try to escape the conflagration, wanting to cross the bridge over the stream. But quarantine militia, pick handles ready, block their way, leaving them to huddle in a no man's land to wait. Sparks fly into the steeple of the church. Soon it becomes a furnace, consuming its beams. Unsupported, its bells crash into the sanctuary below. All of Chinatown hears this dirge.
And the church.
Kamakapili, the first location for Kamakapili on Smith and Baratania. And that's why they had to move to Palama, where they are now.
The current site, yes, yeah. Yes.
That was the time of my grandfather and his generation, pioneers who had come in around the 1880s, 1890s to Hawaii, and many of them did settle in Chinatown. This was even before the 1900 fire. And so I wanted to write about his pioneer generation. So I was fixated on that particular time and that particular place in Chinatown, but also Chinese who lived in the rural areas as well.
And, you know, as I was looking at some of the photos of the Chinatown fire and the plague, they're just stunning, really.
Yes.
You know, yeah. What the people went through.
The context of the poem that I just read really is something like they discovered in December of 1899, December 12th, one person in Chinatown died, and they discovered it was bubonic plague that had come from China. And so then more deaths followed, and they eventually decided, the Board of Health, to have a quarantine, a lockdown, but only of the Chinatown area. And so this started just before the new year, 1900. And they did that and had militia patrolling the streets around Chinatown. It was about 16 blocks. After that, what happened was if there were more people who died, wherever somebody had died, basically they decided to burn that particular structure and evict everybody else and put them in detention camps. And so from around New Year's to January 20th, about 3 weeks, they burnt down at least one building per day because there were more deaths. And unfortunately, on January 20th, the fire got out of control and burnt down all of Chinatown, 38 acres, nearly all of the 16 blocks of Chinatown. There's some remnants, but primarily all of Chinatown was burnt down. So what was cordoned off in a lockdown period for about 3 or 4 weeks, it just disappeared. That was a really unfortunate, you know, traumatic experience for the 7,000 people that were living in the area. You can see some photos just after the fire where there's remnants of the church still standing. There are a few trees that were still standing, but everything else is just vacant land. It's like a volcano crater. There's just nothing there. And so people had to start from scratch and rebuild. So if you go to Chinatown now and you look and see some of the buildings, you can see that they have the date of when the building was erected. Some of them are 1901, 1902, but nothing is before 1900.
And so what is your present-day connection to Chinatown?
Well, my grandfather had a store in Chinatown. It burnt down like everybody else's. He eventually rebuilt that particular building, had a store again. And we've been in Chinatown for the next generation. So I'm a third generation member of our family who has been in Chinatown for all this time.
And so do you have a store down there?
We have an office there. So yes, we're in real estate right now.
And so I guess when you think of Chinatown today and this time in history, you put together this book of poetry, and it's called The Old Timers. But this is your third book.
Yes.
And so what makes this, say, different from your first two?
Well, the other two, I was exploring other topics. The first one was about my family and being a Chinese American. And the second one was specifically about the Nanjing Massacre in China. So this particular book was about 8 years worth of work, just researching and then writing poems. There's about 82 poems in the book trying to describe what happened during that period of time, circa 1900, in the Chinese community in Hawaii. So I do describe some things like what they did as far as employment, all the jobs that they took. I talk about their relationships with other people like the Native Hawaiians. And I also try to describe what they did to organize themselves so that they could have a community primarily of bachelors, because they were not able to bring their women to Hawaii. So primarily a society of bachelors who had to form a new kind of a society that is different from what they had in the villages back home.
And then what can you say about the current day Chinese societies that still, you know, exist in Chinatown?
Well, it's completely different. The people who are still in Chinatown, or the Chinese community in general in Hawaii, are the descendants of those who were able to procreate. There are a lot of the pioneer generation that were not able to marry, were not able to bring their wives, and so they basically died off. They did not have any progeny. There are others who intermarried, married Native Hawaiian women, and had families. So there's a large population of part Hawaiian, part Chinese, and there are also Chinese who were primarily of a merchant or a successful entrepreneur class, and they had progeny who are the main descendants of the Chinese community here at present.
That was poet Wing Tek Lum talking about the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fires in Hawaii'i. Lum says the first poem in the section about the fires is about rodents, and ironically, after the fire was Chinese New Year, which happened to celebrate the Year of the Rat. The conversation also spoke to Wing Tek Lum back in 2021, where he talked more about what was destroyed in the Great Fire. He told HBR's Noe Tanigawa about his grandfather's store, and he read his poem entitled In the Store.
Well, the store is inspired by my grandfather's own store, which was called Wing Tek Chong. It was actually a meeting place. It had all kinds of different wares.
Did it look a lot like Chinatown looks right now?
Yes. So people could actually see what they were getting. People could pick and choose which kinds of tea they wanted to get. Or sometimes they wanted to get fresh ginger, so they wanted to get the ginger grown here. So they could pick and choose what they wanted. But the general store also served as a meeting place where people could exchange news, exchange gossip. They could talk story with each other.
Would you read us some of the poem?
The rumors about the fight at the sugar mill swirl around the saltfish and traveler's plum, the sleek sausages hanging under the open transom, the dried scallops, fat medallions of gold, sorted by origin in wicker baskets. A barber comes in early to buy some young ginger, but stays a while to chat with the schoolteacher's petite wife, who is looking for peanut oil. Before she leaves, she coaxes her toddler to recite a quatrain out loud. All the uncles applaud, and the little girl gets to choose a rock candy from the tall glass jar under the counter. At noon, a clerk is sent out to buy vegetables. Another clerk doubles as the cook, and everyone eats their lunches discreetly, standing at their stations. They leave the scraps for the pair of calico cats, just enough to keep them coming around, but not enough to stop their hunt for rats. Rather than losing it again, a gambler sends his night's winnings to his mother. The cashier collects his money and will mail a coded letter back to the village where an elder holds a chest of silver for the store.
That was Wing Tek Lum, interviewed for The Conversation by Noe Tanigawa. Lum's latest poetry collection is entitled The Old Timers.
Thank you.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Alan Bromley, At the Edge of Forever, mixed-media print-based works that explore themes such as memory, loss, and the environment. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Live from the Atherton, HPR presents the return of our Mele Hawaii performance series. Performing live at our Honolulu studios are Kilia, Keao Ho, the Malie Lyman Quartet, and Hi'ikua. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, as a new year and a new legislative session begins, we find out what's new with Transform Hawaii Gov. We'll talk to Executive Director of THG and find out what initiatives are on the priority list for 2025. That's today at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Glenn Mason is the vice president at Mason Architects in Honolulu, with offices on Merchant Street. The firm specializes in historic preservation. Mason is an American Institute of Architects fellow and has worked on many of Hawaii's most important historic sites. We hanaho a walking tour with him through Chinatown, which he took with HPR's Noe Tanigawa back in 2022.
We moved into Chinatown in 1982. When we moved there, it was... I'm not sure it was at its nadir, but it was pretty low down. About a year after we moved into Chinatown, the last restaurant that was open in all of downtown Honolulu closed. And for 1 year, there was not a single restaurant open in Chinatown or downtown at night. It's hard to believe. This was probably 83, maybe 84. There were no restaurants open at night. None. Chinatown developed primarily because of the harbor. It was very harbor-oriented at the time it was developed. So when you get to where Murphy's is, that's in Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
So now we just walked into Chinatown. And you can see, actually, one of the things that's really cool, Murphy's has this. They've got all of these Chinese granite pavers. These are original pavers.
And you mean these square blocks?
These square blocks. They're granite. They're probably about 4 inches thick, set as pavement. These came over as ballast in ships from China. Because in the very beginning, we were shipping out lots of things like sandalwood. We basically raped our forests in order to get sandalwood to ship to the east. And when the ships came back, they were empty. And one of the things that they did was they used stones as ballast when they came back. And so this is all left over from probably pre-1900 paving. This is called the Foster Block, actually.
The Foster Block with the tools there, the Nipujiji building.
Exactly. That entire brick building and the small building behind it actually did survive the fire. This is as far down as the fire got. There was a terrible fire in 1886 and then another one in 1900. As a result, many of the buildings that were built after 1900 were built with brick or stone. Most of the buildings that we're looking at in Chinatown date from that time period. Now, they built some wood buildings at the same time because they were cheap, they were easy to put up, but almost all, maybe all of those buildings are gone now. So the remarkable thing about Chinatown is its scale. I mean, almost every building is two stories. There's a few three-story buildings and an occasional building that's four stories, except for the newer developments that the city has made by inserting housing into Chinatown, which actually is a good trade-off because it actually brought life back into Chinatown. I mean, before there was a substantial amount of housing in Chinatown, it was dead at night. Well, it wasn't exact. Yeah, except, again, when we moved into Chinatown, there were probably six porno movie theaters or porno arcades in Chinatown. And it was, you know, a place that people went for bars to drink and find drugs and go to porno movie theaters. And so that was it. And you walk around now and you don't see any of that, which is great. And a lot of that came from not only individual developers coming in and fixing up buildings, but I do attribute some of it to the city bringing people into Chinatown, people who live in Chinatown.
That was what they were trying to do, right? HUD money to put people right there in the Gateway Plaza.
Well, every one of the city's projects where they've developed these high-rise housing areas or even mid-range housing, those were parking lots. Harbor Court was what parking lot.
Yeah.
It actually, believe it or not, Harbor Court, that site, when they did the archaeological investigations, they found that that site was the site of Kamehameha the First's house site when he was on Oahu. The history of the use of this harbor goes back at least a couple hundred years that we know of. So,
when they built these buildings, what are they in the style of?
Well, I think that you have to look at eras. Let's assume that you look at things from the time of the fire on. For the next 25, 30 years, people were building buildings that looked like buildings elsewhere in the United States. Starting in the mid-20s, there was a very strong drive to try to come up with an architecture, a design style that was individual to Hawaii, called Hawaiian regionalism. And there are buildings in Chinatown, like Wo Fats, which definitely try to say, we're unique to Hawaii, we're unique to this place. The thing is that, you know, we call it Chinatown, and it, of course, it had a very high proportion of Chinese living in it and working in it. But the peak of Chinese residents in Chinatown was probably 56% right after the fire. And then, of course, it decreased gradually from that point on. And today, when you walk around Chinatown, it's filled with Vietnamese and Filipinos. And, I mean, the food itself is from all over. It's all over the Pacific. And so, you know, that's just the nature of Chinatown. It's always been a center for non-native community, I think, if you want to call it that. But one of the things that I think is really important to talk about, and this is partially my interpretation, what makes Chinatown special is scale. Of course, the history. But how does the history get expressed? We tend to think of historic districts like this as individual buildings. And that's not really what it's about. It's about the buildings, but it's also about the street pattern, the view planes, and everything else. It's a composite of everything. We're walking along here under a canopy. There are blocks in Chinatown. You can walk around the entire block when it's pouring rain and not get wet. But this is a characteristic of Chinatown.
Oh, you're right. I mean, it makes it so nice to walk up this street.
We're not in the sun, and when it's raining, we're protected. And you look around, that's a characteristic of Chinatown, right? But again, it's everything. It's lava rock curbstones, and I can see the mountains looking up Nuuanu Avenue. That's important.
So. Look, I can see the ocean. I see the harbor.
Yeah, well, exactly.
You know, so on this one street, I see the harbor, I see the ocean, and I see the mountains.
Right. Right. And that's so easily lost. Design of canopies. I mean, you see the break in the decorative element at the edge there. Well, these canopies were all designed at a time when everything was a little shorter. And so now they have great big delivery trucks that come by and they bang into these canopies. Well, the canopies sometimes extend out to and sometimes even slightly beyond the curb. But do you want to whack them all back? By and large, what's happened is the building owners in Chinatown have really fixed up their properties. I mean, you go in some of the, all this, you know, brick fire tavern and all these places that we're looking at here. They're pretty nice buildings. I mean, the owners have done a really nice job fixing up these buildings on the inside. And so I'm actually very optimistic.
You know, what is with this bizarre Chinatown architecture where you go inside the building, you walk up two floors toward the back, and then you come out to a veranda over a garden?
Oh, yeah.
You know, what kind of architecture is this?
Look, if the lot is big enough, remember, all of these buildings were designed to be naturally ventilated. They couldn't be big blocks of buildings. And so they're all relatively thin. And if you have a deep lot, you're not going to build the building the full depth of the lot, because then you have no air. When you look at a building like the Mendonca block that has a nice courtyard, that courtyard was built partially because after more than about 50 feet deep, you have no ventilation. And so all the buildings that were built in downtown Honolulu, elsewhere, they all tried to stay relatively thin, and that's the only way that human comfort was even remotely possible before we air conditioned the living daylights out of everything. But again, there was not a lot of creative architecture here. People were building buildings that were kind of, I would just say, normal buildings. But there's a certain amount of, the modularity of brick. The modularity
of
stone.
What do you mean by that modularity?
Well, one of the nice things about brick is that the shape and the size of a brick is a module that's very easy to understand and grasp, and or even a stone that's a little bit larger. That modularity creates a certain texture that is more human scale than, you know, a building that's just completely plastered flat. And I think that modularity that is expressed in brick and stone and some other materials is actually one of the things that appeals to people. It gives a building a certain texture. The scale is not only the height of the buildings, it's the scale and modularity of the materials they're made out of. And even the sidewalks, when you look at, you know, this is actually the only, we're standing outside of the old Club Hubba Hubba building, but it's the only place in Chinatown where there's actually remnant slate sidewalk.
Wow.
And that blends into, again, the original Chinese granite pavers.
But, you know, you're pointing out to me also that there are so many different textures that I'm seeing here.
Oh,
you know, and they're worn. They're not brand spanking new. You know what I mean?
No. Well, I mean, and one of the things about Chinatown is even the signage in Chinatown is just much more exuberant. And part of that is that you just have all these different storefronts, one after another, right? But part of it is that's the nature of Chinatown. I mean, I'm hoping that eventually more of the signs will be saved, because I think they tell the history of the place, again, as much as the buildings do.
Yeah.
But there's all these little things, idiosyncratic things that they're interesting, but they lend depth to our existence, frankly. And that depth, that knowledge about our past, is really important. And I don't care whether you're talking about Hawaiian history or, you know, the history of Japanese in Hawaii or the history of Chinese in Hawaii. All of that layers together to create the place that we live in. And if we're not sensitive to this stuff, then, I mean, why are we here? We aren't New York City. We aren't even San Francisco. You know, we are our own place. And I think knowing the history of this place and why, and, you know, what's special about it is really important to understanding who we are.
That was architect Glenn Mason, principal at Mason Architects, and HBR's Noe Tanigawa as they walk through Chinatown in 2022. It included the Foster Block, where Murphy's Bar and Grill is located near the harbor. The Irish pub survived the Great Fire of 1900. Mason has worked on many of Hawaii's historic sites, such as I'Ōlani Palace and Kauai Ha'o Church. We hope you enjoyed reflecting on the history of the fire department and our Chinatown. That is it for our Aloha Friday show. Coming up next week, we hear from Pacific content creators about the chaos around the TikTok ban. So much uncertainty. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote, Tori DeJournay, and Mark Liddell. The Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John Mello. Our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.